This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is Inside Story with Lee Chui Lin and Sharmila Ganesan. Tonight, we are putting COP26 in focus.
First, what big decisions have been made so far and why are activists saying it's simply not enough? Secondly, we examine whether there's still value in these sorts of diplomatic conferences. Lastly, the voice of youth activists has been loud and clear. We look at what they're calling for.
So we want to know, do you think that COP26 has been effective so far? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:08 and we are going to be spending this hour talking about COP26 and what it has and has not yet done. So it is running, of course, from October 31st to November 12th in Glasgow. It is the biggest conference of its kind, focused entirely on climate change, bringing together world leaders and some notable absences, which we can get to.
So if we just take a glance at the website, some of the major issues that COP26 is meant to address includes securing global net zero by the mid-century and to keep the 1.5 degrees within reach, to adapt to protect communities and natural habitats, to mobilize finance specifically to deliver on those two first goals. The developed countries need to essentially deliver on their promise to mobilize at least $100 billion in climate finance per year, and of course to work together to deliver this. So it's a lot and it's vague, all right? I'll just start off with that. And I think therein lies some of the challenges as well as the criticism of an event like this.
It's like a climate change.
You laughed so soon that I couldn't even keep my face straight.
I'm sorry. Work together to deliver. What is this? A climate change gotong royong? Like, you know, there has to be more... I mean, and this is something that we're actually seeing even with the resolutions that have been signed, even with some of the pledges that have come out of the conference. While they sound great, reversing deforestation by 2030, for example, is one of the big ones. Focusing on methane reduction, that's another big one that people are talking about. None of them are necessarily enforceable. And in fact, when asked whether there are going to be enforcements put in place, they were like, you know, we didn't really get there. It's not really about that. What it is about is the commitment to doing it and the fact that countries are putting money where their mouths are. You know, that's kind of been the answer whenever there's been any push towards asking, okay, yes, all well and good, these are the goals, but how are we going to make sure that it's met? So I think therein lies one of the first main criticisms of COP26, which is something that we can, again, go into in more detail, because if we look at the decisions that have been made thus far, there have been promises, like we mentioned earlier, to curb deforestation, to phase out coal, to end funding for fossil fuels abroad, cut methane emissions. More than 120 countries have actually agreed to end and reverse deforestation by 2030. How exactly is still vague, but there is a pledge. And countries representing more than 70% of the world's economy are committed to delivering clean and affordable technology everywhere by 2030 in the most polluting sectors. So these are just some examples.
So you mentioned absences, right? And you know, on that note of 70% of the world economy, China didn't essentially appear. President Xi Jinping chose not to represent the country at COP26. That's something that hasn't gone unremarked upon.
They did send a delegate.
And Russia then also similarly didn't necessarily put up much of a commitment either. So these are some of the things that people have been pointing out. And I think the collective disappointment, I want to say, is at least part of the reason why we saw the protest that happened on Saturday, where protesters marched through downtown Glasgow in the rain, demanding for bolder action from the conference. And protests around the world happened in solidarity with this. And they covered a few things, right? So they talked about the exclusion of activists from these negotiations. They talked about a lack of progress after 2.5 decades of meetings like this. They also expressed doubt that policymakers and leaders would actually serve the interests of marginalized people.
That point about marginalized people is very crucial because there is this discussion about the division between the global north, generally the people who are making waves and making promises at the conference, and the global south, generally the people who are most affected by climate change, the people who are seeing the real impacts of that on their homes, their jobs, their families. And we are seeing a lot of youth activists from the global south, including us, of course, us here in Southeast Asia. We're also talking about continents like Africa, we're talking about South America, bringing this up and saying, okay, why weren't we at the table? Why aren't Indigenous voices being focused on more prominently? Why isn't there that focus? And I think the hope was that the protests would go some way towards applying pressure outside the conference to inside the conference to say, hey, listen, we are here, we are listening. And we need you to do something. In fact, one of the activists talked about how it was important for them to bring forward their point of view because then at least those inside the conference can't say that they didn't know. You can't say that other forms or other ideas, other suggestions weren't presented because they were, just not within the conference at the protests.
I think a lot of these dissenting voices also made themselves heard through the young people, and that was something that because of social media and because of people like Greta Thunberg, as well as a whole host of other young activists, particularly activists from, as you said, from the global south, from Indigenous communities, just speaking up about issues that are not so much policy level or big picture, but about the real daily impact of the climate crisis. To me personally, that was much more inspiring than the outcome of the conference itself.
Yes. So we are going to be focused on what's emerged from COP26 thus far. That's going to be our first discussion. But we want to know, do you think that COP26 has been effective? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we'll be speaking with Yin Chao Long, Senior Research Associate at Khazanah Research Institute. Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 6:16. You're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We're focused today on COP26, and that is what we're starting off with now, specifically looking at what has emerged so far. It's not yet over, but the kinds of pledges and promises that have emerged, and protests as well. To do so, we're crossing over to Yin Chao Long, Senior Research Associate at Khazanah Research Institute. Chao Long, thanks for speaking with us.
Hi, Lynn, Sharmila. Thanks for having me on.
So what are your initial impressions so far?
Well, with these kind of COPs, it's hard to say because we're only at the halfway point in a two-week process. And so there's a lot of negotiation that's happened and that is still that remains to be sealed by the end of this week, if it is possible to achieve a consensus on it.
And we've seen several big promises made already within the first week. Could you walk us through some that have perhaps received the most attention?
I think it's important to distinguish between the sort of two COPs, basically, right? There's the external, carefully orchestrated circus on the outside that has captured a lot of media attention in the first week that has involved leaders of countries, you know, making big declarations and so forth. And the sort of workshop, workhorse COP, which is basically working behind the scenes outside of media attention on the actual negotiations on quite technical matters. But these are the matters that really are the core of the agreement to move us ahead on a kind of common collective global climate agenda. And that agenda is still very much under negotiation. So I think you pointed out earlier, you've got this kind of forest declaration and so forth like that. These are actually outside of the UN process. They are sort of, in a way, I think it's important to recognize that these are sort of carefully orchestrated public relations efforts by the COP presidency, which is the UK, to have a kind of big bang opening. But I think it's important to distinguish that from actually substantive, binding, actionable commitments that would actually lead to countries around the world collectively trying to prevent sort of catastrophic climate change within the next 10 to even 20, 30 years.
So if we look at the pledges then, you know, has anything really stood out to you?
I think one of the interesting things is that a lot of attention is focused on things like the forest pledge, where You know, people have questioned whether, you know, why Malaysia isn't part of that and so forth. I don't think it matters that much because it's a non-binding pledge. It's largely, you know, it's one of a series of declarations that have emerged over the years that doesn't really have a concrete mechanism towards it. It has a lot of motherhood statements. What really matters is actually what are our domestic policies, what are our domestic targets towards protecting our forests, and even in some cases restoring the forests that have been lost. So I think we have to look past the theatrics and we have to look at the substance. There has been a lot of discussion about climate finance. And not a lot of progress. There's still basically a fundamental economic tension cutting through all the climate negotiations over the last 20 or so years that split rich developed countries who have historically been the biggest emitters and poorer developing countries, and Malaysia is numbered amongst them despite our middle income status. And these are the countries that have less finance, less economic resources, and have contributed less to the greenhouse gas emissions that are responsible for global warming. And that economic divide is actually is what people fight over in these negotiations. You have the rich countries, of course, most of the problem, who are being asked to cough up climate finance and to help vulnerable countries adapt to the impacts of climate change. But there's resistance to making concrete financial commitments. There's an interest in sort of pushing this towards the private sector for more voluntary financing mechanisms, loans and sort of grants. But then you have a lot of developing countries who are effectively debt-ridden, struggling even before the pandemic to cope with the cost of just, you know, public finance, and that has become worse in the last 2 years as a result of the global economic crisis that's been caused by the pandemic as well. So there's a lot of, I would say, sort of stinginess and some of the disappointing behavior on the international stage that we've seen with the COVID-19 pandemic is depressingly familiar to those of us who worked in climate change for a long time. We see those similar attitudes. There's a public push towards being talking about, you know, being one world and so forth. But when it gets down to the brass tacks, it's really about personal, national, economic interest and what you can do to move ahead on that, and what you can be pressured into conceding. That said, I think it's very important to recognize that, when I first started working on climate negotiations, you know, 21 years ago, there is a tremendous increase in the amount of attention, pressure, and response today than there was before. There has been progress on that front. You know, there's a generation of activists out there, not just Greta Thunberg, but others that are working with her, also from Malaysia, who are in Glasgow today as well, who understand that the climate crisis is something that their generation has to face up to. And that action needs to be taken. And it's important that the negotiations actually begin to reflect this more and more.
So you mentioned earlier that there are two COPs almost. Now, could you explain what the format and structure of the conference is and how do countries actually arrive at agreements?
The real COP, or the true COP I alluded to earlier, is the kind of the workshop COP, where the negotiations happen. And these are negotiations, they're not really done by prime ministers or by ministers. You know, they're done by civil servants and other members of technical experts that are on national delegations. And so Malaysia has already had a delegation there since last week, right? Just along with many other countries. The presence or absence of the minister or given minister matters less in those initial stages. What you do need are technical experts who can attend, I think there's up to like maybe 26 different discussions. And there's quite a lot of ground for, you know, particularly for smaller, poorer countries to cover in terms of their capacity over various mechanisms ranging from finance, as I mentioned before, what to do about climate adaptation, what to do about market mechanisms like carbon trading, what to do with the issue of loss and damage, which is effectively reparations for those countries that have already experienced catastrophic climate damage, like small island states. There's a lot of arguing over the substance of negotiation texts. And these negotiation texts are important in the sense that they're legal documents, binding, but they generally will not have penalties within the climate framework. But they will become, they will establish precedents that will shape the framework of future discussions and how resources, obligations, and finance are mobilized. And also, it creates the architecture for a lot of other what you could call non-state actors, like the private sector, multilateral institutions, civil society, and so forth, to take some kind of constructive climate action. So this is the patient work that goes on every time there's a COP over the last now 27 years, because they skipped a year because of COVID, right? Mm. So this is the core work that's done in negotiations. And it's not always easy to receive, achieve a consensus because of the kinds of economic interests that divide countries. Because if you think about it, the basis of greenhouse gas emissions is your power supply, right? And the power supply and the amount of power that you can burn to fuel your economy is a proxy for your economic growth. So if other things being equal, you are asked to curtail your greenhouse gas emissions, it may mean that you are facing up to curtailing your economic growth potential, unless there's sort of technologies and means for you to transition to a kind of cleaner, i.e. more renewable or lower kind of carbon pathway. So it really it becomes a very thorny issue for negotiation for both, you know, the biggest emitters, like, say, the U.S., and also upcoming countries like, say, China, which on paper looks like it has large emissions, but they have one of the largest populations in the world. So you have to also understand that emissions need to be looked at not just historically, not just presently on a national basis, but also on a per-person, per-capita basis as well.
You mentioned finances. How important is money in achieving these global climate targets?
I mean, think of it this way. Take Malaysia's example, right? I mean, we're not terribly poor, but yet we're still fiscally constrained, right? We don't always have enough money to even fight the pandemic as much as we would like, right? We can still see that, say, you know, ministries like the Ministry of Health still don't get enough budget despite the pandemic happening the last 2 years because we're worried about the debt level being too high, let alone to fight climate change, right? And there's relatively little money devoted towards fighting climate change under the present budget, Budget 2022. So can you imagine how it is for a smaller, poorer country, like a less developed country, like our neighbors within ASEAN, or small island developing states that are highly dependent on tourism that has been crushed by the pandemic? And even before then, they had very little industry. You know, they may be dependent upon agriculture. So these kinds of states, they need a tremendous amount of finance to both achieve a number of things. One, to reduce their vulnerability to climate change. This may mean like flood mitigation, kind of coastal barriers, you know, flood barriers in the coast, measures to prevent coastal erosion. They also may, and even ourselves, we need technological transfer in order to have better access and cheaper access and more reliable access to produce clean energies, rather than paying a premium price on the international market for them. They may need technical expertise in order to understand how best to deploy these kinds of resources. They may need to compensate people who've already suffered damages and loss as a result of climate change that's already gone on. You need to do things like rehabilitate coral reefs. It's not cheap. And coral reefs support fishermen, right? And marine ecologies and marine economies. So there's a lot of finance. A lot of financial needs, but there's completely insufficient finance. This $100 billion that, you know, has been talked about is just a token amount, honestly. It's not enough. If you look at the last 2 years, I think the developed countries mobilized about $2 trillion U.S. dollars in quantitative easing and other kinds of unconventional fiscal measures just to bail themselves and their companies out of the pandemic, right?
Shalom, we have 30 seconds left. What developments are you looking out for?
Well, within the next week, we need to see a genuine movement on climate finance so that developing countries actually get the financial support that they need. Adaptation, which is being pushed by the Africa Group, really needs to move forward, and U.S. opposition to it needs to end. We also need to have a deal on loss and damage, which are reparations for the damage that's already been done, that is fair and equitable and helps people rebuild their lives. Ultimately, we need to see Malaysia also figure out what its place is within this kind of climate architecture that's going to be advanced ever so slightly in Glasgow.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Shalom.
Thank you.
That was Yin Chao Leung, Senior Research Associate at Khazanah Research Institute, weighing in on COP26 so far, about 1 week in. We've been asking you, do you think it's been effective? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It is 6:38 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We're talking today about the COP26 UN Climate Conference, which is currently at the halfway mark. It is running in Glasgow. And so far, they've emerged with some pledges, some important pledges, albeit without necessarily a lot of specificity. They have, however, also been beset by protests, by people saying that there isn't enough being done. There's been too much exclusion applied. You know, activists have not been heard. And so we just wanted to take a closer look at the conference as a whole. We spoke earlier about what's emerged thus far, what we can look forward to in the second half. We've also been asking you, how effective do you think COP26 has been so far? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
So both messages that we, these two messages have, I think, a running theme here, let's say. So Kinwai says, of all the meetings in the world, COP26 could definitely have been a Zoom meeting. It's so ironically funny for them to take private jets from all around the world and tell us ordinary people to be wary of carbon emission. And on that same note, Tan Han Wei says, how much fossil fuels used to fly these representatives and the motorcade to look and the motorcade to locations and the motorcade fuel burned for these meetings? They don't even think green on how to conduct the meeting, how do they expect real tangible action to be taken?
A frequent criticism, really, of these sorts of environmental conferences, right? When it comes to private jets and fossil fuels and all the rest of it. But I think that this really opens us up for our next segment, which is the viability of these sorts of conferences. And I think balancing the need for them versus how effective they actually are. So that's what we're going to be discussing next. But we would like to continue hearing from you. Do you think that COP26 has been effective so far? We are at the halfway mark. You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. And now focusing on the nature of these conferences and whether they're set to change, we're crossing over to Boon Nagara, Honorary Research Fellow of the Perak Academy. Boon, as always, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lynn, Sharmila.
So over the years, how effective or successful have the COP events actually been?
Well, it depends who you ask as well. I mean, to the conference organizers, they tend to say that these events have been successful. But actually, success or failure should be judged by what action, if any, has been taken and whether that action, if taken at all, is sufficient or adequate based on what has been pledged and agreed upon. Unfortunately, so far, it is quite disappointing. The achievements have not been even up to what have been agreed, let alone anything more than that.
So to hone in on that a little bit, the thing we often hear is that what emerges from these conferences are just PR statements or vague resolutions. What do you make of this sort of criticism?
Well, I think, yes, it would be nice to have clearer and more detailed benchmarks and objectives. But I think what is more serious is that the failure to meet past agreements that have been pledged and agreed upon by all these countries, you know, nearly 200 countries. And, for example, the present COP of COP26 is essentially a reaffirmation of the Paris Agreement that was reached back in 2015, that is COP21. Well, a number of things have happened, unfortunately, that have set that back. For example, the COVID pandemic and U.S. Under Trump pulling out, last November of the Paris Agreement. And of course, the feeling that jobs have been threatened, the economy and so on, if there's any serious change on climate issues. But, you know, this is all very unfortunate because to even have to reference something that was agreed upon 6 years ago shows that there is a lack of progress on the issues.
And from a geopolitical point of view, what value do these conferences hold? I mean, do most world leaders take this as an opportunity to push forward or showcase specific agendas?
Well, again, it's unfortunate that the realities are such that what you say is quite correct, because world leaders being politicians, they tend to use such events to position themselves and posture, you know, in a grandiose way around the world to show their policy superiority, if you can call it that. And, you know, unfortunately, the real action that's needed has not been done. For example, it was agreed back in 2015 that global warming should be reduced to under significantly less than 2 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels, and for countries to aim for no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius increase this century. But unfortunately, given the latest indications from all these countries, we are set to see an increase in global temperatures of 2.7 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, which is way off the mark and, you know, really very damaging to the planet.
So we read a few messages earlier pointing out the carbon footprint of COP. Now, could these meetings have been done virtually? How would that have impacted diplomacy?
Well, unfortunately, again, the access has been a problem. Okay, these events are organized by the UN, and so, you know, you can expect the major role to be taken by countries, that is to say, governments of countries. But civil society groups have been left out, and these include very important groups like the Climate Action Network, which represents some 1,500 organizations around the world from about 130 countries. And they have been shut off. And the criticism mainly has been that previous COP summits have not been very promising, and this year has been the worst because of the restrictions on their participation. The British government, being the host of this event this year, says that the restrictions are necessary because of the pandemic, you know, social distancing and such conditions. But apparently even virtual participation has been limited and a problem. So even organizations that are recognized by the UN as relevant civil society groups have been shut out. So, you know, this is seems to be another giant photo opportunity and little else. And that is the criticism coming from the civil society sector, although, you know, it is hard to deny such allegations as well.
So how can this be improved moving forward then? I mean, is there a way to create more of an inclusion, whether it's virtually or otherwise?
Well, there has to be some serious and meaningful changes. For example, I think the civil society, relevant civil society groups need to have a bigger input and participation. And this is really the result of the decisions made by the organizing country and the participating governments as well. Secondly, I think the technocrats have to be given a higher profile and bigger participation. You know, the experts working in these fields with the knowledge, experience and expertise, and not just the policymakers. The technocrats need to work more closely with the policymakers to come up with really meaningful changes and to actually stick to the agreements that have been made. Unfortunately, governments tend to be also under pressure or face inducements from industry back home. And for example, the oil and gas producers will be against any limits on fossil fuel consumption. The timber industry will be against measures against deforestation or even reversing the deforestation and, you know, and so on. So these issues have to be ironed out, and, you know, bigger participation by the experts in addition to the policymakers will have to come through if there's going to be any meaningful change.
So could you envision a time in which we move away from these sorts of diplomatic events, and what might take their place?
Well, it's hard to see any meaningful change if we go by the record so far, because there hasn't been much that is encouraging. So the hope, of course, is that there will be meaningful changes and that they will come soon. But it's difficult to say when or even if they will come about. So I think we have seen the devastation already, you know, small island nations, for example, being inundated because of rising sea levels as a result of melting polar ice caps. And also even inland countries in Europe recently have been subjected to severe flooding. So there's a lot of damage being done, continues to be done, as well as the destruction of livelihoods, as well as lives. So I think governments generally have to wake up very fast and seriously if the worst is to be averted. So I don't see basically any particular point in time in which this would happen.
Boon, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Boon Nagara, Honorary Research Fellow of the Perak Academy, weighing in on the benefits and perhaps the pros and cons, really, of having these large-scale diplomatic events. The one we are focusing on today is COP26, which has come under some criticism for not going far enough to address the issues of climate change. We'd like to hear from you, really. Do you think that COP26 has been effective thus far? You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We do have some messages. First up, this from Philip.
So Philip says, SMART goal setting. If all we get are non-binding pledges, then it won't change much. Yes, and I would add, if by smart you mean specific, then I'm there for it. I do think that sometimes the problem is, one, yes, the non-binding pledges. The other, the fact that goals often can seem fairly vague and stretched out over decades, in which case not a lot needs to be done in the short term.
That, and I'm going to use a phrase that I don't enjoy, but that I've heard used a lot in the context of COP, and that is the devil being in the details. Because what happens at these sorts of conferences is that you have presidents and prime ministers and premiers coming out at press conferences, lots of P's there, sorry, and then saying, here's what we've pledged to do. This is what we're going to do. And then everything after that is in the details, exactly how this is ironed out between countries, exactly how different countries plan to achieve this. You know, what even down to money, how much is going to be spent for this, how much is going to go from one country to another, all these things are in the details. And ultimately, I think being able to determine the efficacy of something is going to depend on how specific you want to get in the details. So yes, smart goal setting is important, but I think also clearer communication and maybe closer attention from everybody on what is actually being said matters. We also have Adrian, who says, you know, COP is not merely referencing the Paris Agreement. It's part of the process to review the rule book, specifically finance. Access to COP26 has been constant and open. It's a platform for the government. It's G2G. NGOs are only observers from day one. They're never, ever allowed to sit or speak on the table. You don't expect an NGO to sit in on the parliament table, right? COP26 is a policy government-only platform. Technocrats or scientists are invited to submit papers to guide the negotiations, but never given a seat on it. It's like you going to a mamak and trying to order a pasta. It would be unfair if you are not served or you blame the restaurant to be a failure.
I do think, though, that just because something is the way it's always been done doesn't mean that there isn't an opportunity to do it better. And that's partly what one of the things that these protests were highlighting, the fact that the people who work on the ground with communities, activists who have been working on the climate crisis, were not given an opportunity to make their voices heard. And I do think that that's a valid point to bring up.
Yeah, I think the other aspect is of it being government to government is that if you therefore don't like what's coming out of the negotiations, that this is what you end up having, like you end up having protests. But I think that this comes back to what we're expecting from our representatives, and that's what our governments are supposed to be there for. But otherwise, you're absolutely right in terms of the process-driven nature of the COP itself. Let us know, though, do you think that COP26 has been effective thus far? Again, you can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we talk about the voice of young climate change activists. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Break from mediocrity. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:52 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We are focused today on COP26 and now we want to talk about the youth voice that has really been calling out, making demands, right, of the conference. And joining us now to speak on this is Aru Ayoni, researcher at Klima Action Malaysia. Aru, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So firstly, do you feel that there was enough youth representation at COP26?
I think there's definitely a lot more youth at this moment, more representative. But then I don't know much because this is also my first COP. But I do know that the youth have been organizing nonstop since the beginning of the pandemic. Up until today, even until the second week of COP, we're still trying to get our friends from the most vulnerable countries to get to COP. But I'm actually quite disappointed that Malaysia has not been able to send Indigenous youth delegates or representatives. But I think it's really important to note that COP is usually mostly accessible to people who live in the global north and English-speaking individuals. And this situation has made worse by the pandemic and now vaccine inequity. So yes, I do think there's more youth representation, but we are still missing the voices of people who are the most vulnerable to the climate crisis.
So it's been reported that the views of over 40,000 young climate leaders were presented to the negotiators and officials. What does this signify?
It signifies that the youth are aware of what's happening and that we can finally believe that we can take matters into our own hands. But then this kind of symbolic action can also mean a lot of things because, as you know, the youth have always been used as token to represent a new era or like a monumental change. So I think this isn't any different. But I think what matters is the action after those views are presented to negotiators and officials. Like, what will they do? Or is this just another catchy headlines that officials use to get media's attention?
Now, observers have also pointed out a disconnect between the concerns and demands of youth activists and the responses of world leaders, or what's coming out of the conference itself. What are youth groups highlighting and calling for action on?
So we are calling out for world leaders, calling out for their inaction, false solution, and also greenwashing. I think it is important for our voices to be heard, for truth to be spoken in these spaces. Polluters need to be made accountable, especially when we are demanding real solutions. So right now we are calling for a phase out of fossil fuel, real emission reduction, and a just transition for everyone. So currently the global north are still blocking and delaying actions. They are refusing to pay up for their historical emissions. And we know that the biggest responsibility lies on them. And another thing that the youth are calling for and highlighting is developed countries must deliver the climate finance that was promised, which is $100 billion a year by 2020. But this has been recently pushed to 2023. And even this $100 billion for loss and damage is barely scratching the surface because Global South countries' loss and damage is expected to reach around $300 to $600 billion annually by 2030. So climate finance needs to be delivered fast and fairly, and also prioritizing countries who need it the most.
So Greta Thunberg is, of course, still perhaps the best known among the young climate change activists, but there have been so many others that have been speaking up, and this includes activists from the Global South, countries as diverse as Nigeria, the Philippines, Colombia. Why is it important to have such diverse voices speak up on this, and how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel relieved, the fact that my generation understands why intersectionality and diversity matters in the climate justice movement or any other social justice movement. The fact that we cannot move alone anymore. And it matters because since the beginning of COP and even after the Paris Agreement, right, voices of vulnerable communities have always been sidelined. And these conferences have only been able to create solutions that benefit the rich, polluters, and global north countries. So very little has been made compared to the magnitude of climate emergency that we are facing right now.
We have just a minute left with you, Aru. For young people here in Malaysia who want to make their voices heard on the subject of climate change, what can be done?
Be on the right side of history and don't fall into greenwashing agenda. Pledges made for 2050 should not make you comfortable. So what you can do right now, if you want your voice to be heard, is continue with your individual actions if you are already doing them. Learn about climate change and these negotiations such as COP. Talk to people on social media. Talk to like-minded friends that can help amplify your voice.
Aru, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
You just heard Aru Ayuni, researcher at Klima Action Malaysia, talking to us about the role and the voice of youth climate change activists, a particularly strong tone, I think, that's coming through, and deservedly so, in light of COP26. And we've been asking you for your thoughts on the conference today because it has been, I think it's fair to say it's been criticized. Can we say that?
So mixed reactions, if you're being polite.
All right, mixed reactions / it's been criticized. And that's what we've been focusing on today. We'd like to hear from you. Do you think that COP26 has been effective so far? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. You've been listening to Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.